Welcome to the How to Hide a Dead Body podcast. I'm Patrick Gilbert. This is a podcast where we talk about digital advertising, business consulting, and career growth. With me today is Ben Lee. He's one of our senior team members here at Adventure Media. Ben has a pretty diverse role. He helps us manage campaigns. He helps us with a lot of audiovisual stuff. He helped us build this podcast studio. But most importantly, Ben is the head of our growing analytics department. It's something that we've been putting a lot of effort into over the last year or so in actually really redefining what a data-driven approach is and pulling that back into our client campaigns. And I think this is a really interesting topic because Ben has taught me so much about data science and really just like everything that goes in line with helping our clients unlock more opportunities for increased profit. So thanks for coming on, Ben. I want to start with, can you just give, like, you're one of the most interesting guys that I've ever met, not to set the bar pretty high, but can you give us a background on, you know, how you essentially got here?
Well, that's where do I begin? So let's start from 2009. Let's begin 2009. So Okay. Initially, before, I guess, I moved to digital marketing, My initial dream was to actually become a fashion photographer. So my undergrad was in photography. But at the time, digital marketing was kind of changing the landscape, especially with Instagram and Facebook. The way that you used to kind of pay for a print magazine or pay for an ad in the Vogue was kind of going away. People are not investing that much on print. And a lot of the imagery that you can find on fashion is pretty much free, especially Instagram influencers. So I pivoted to more of the creative production. So still within the advertising space, but I was focused more of creating commercials, whether it's Gatsby or Hello Kitty or KitKat. It was very little data behind it. It's, you know, the creative process is a little different. You sit together in a room, each of them have a different point of view, different kind of taste, come together, you just throw stuff on the wall. Maybe you pitch three different concepts to the client and they like one, you produce it. There's no data that inform our decision of which creative approach works best. So we just deliver the creatives and that's how it is. But after 3 years doing that, I wanted to find a solution to the other side of the story. Before I even arrived at Adventure Media, I started with... I pursued my master's at Chapman University, both in film production and in master's in business administration. So with that, I kind of get a training that's both balanced, both on the creative side and also the data side. And I like that kind of that synergy between, obviously, you know, you're trying to predict which creative kind of drive a particular response. It's not easy, but there's certain magic to it. So after graduating and getting the training and obviously all the internships and whatnot, I was looking for a company that does, just doing digital marketing. And not just that, but also consider, I think, the data side of things. Digital marketing is quite a big kind of a term to use. You could be just simply the mechanics of managing a Google Ads account or Facebook account, where you could just, you know, upload assets, choose your audience, and see which one performed better, and you call it a day. I mean, that's still a service that you can provide. But I think with things changing, especially with when Isaac first came around with the PPC course, and I think a lot of the other agencies kind of, I mean, he was one of the first out there to kind of understand the mechanics of Google or search and marketing. Beyond that, it became, you know, everybody kind of caught on, and you need to kind of evolve alongside, and not just on the agency level, but the industry also is evolving. So I like the fact that he and Isaac and yourself had an eye to evolve alongside, but to kind of future-proof the agency. And it's important to consider that because this is where data comes in. Data does inform Google Ads, does inform Facebook. And the issue at hand most often is there are solutions out there to answer some of the difficult questions, but more often than not, as this data providers or solution providers, end of the day, they want to make money too, so they have to kind of default to a certain templates. Maybe these are the five most popular questions people do ask, and this is the kind of service I can sell. And there's many other questions they can ask by looking at the data set, but more often than not, you cannot do so. And the only way to do so is to really look at a raw data set and ask yourself questions about it, look at it, and then explore with it. And then maybe you have a conclusion, maybe you have not, but it's important to, I guess, go right to the source, rather than have a particular platform or a particular solution provider give you a template kind of, these are the five possible solutions and that's how it is.
So you kind of jumped ahead into the how the actual we're using the mechanics of data right now. But to take a step back, you got into this field from an art perspective or photography, more on the actual what someone would traditionally say is more of a creative background. Yeah. And you pursued that, and you studied film, and you worked in videography, and then all of a sudden you kind of turned that on its head, and you became a sort of a data whiz. Now, when you were growing up, was that a part of, like, did you pursue that with school at all? Because you clearly have an affinity toward that. So did it really happen after the whole photography journey that you realized the importance of diving into data and really getting a better understanding of data science?
That's a good question, because I think, I guess both yes and no. The technical training did come about after photography, even before that, I think a large part of statistics that people tend to forget, I know now business analytics is a big thing. I mean, everybody's getting paid for it, they're providing such services, people love it. But at least the statistics was first and mostly applied to social science. And I've always been inclined to social science. At the end of the day, it's how do you quantify human behavior? At some level of accuracy, and there's always a variance by culture, age, demographic, location. But at the end of the day, the idea of human behavior, trying to understand it, this one brings joy to me. You're just naturally curious to why people behave this way or respond to a particular ad this way. And that to me was the most... fun thing. I don't know where it was like fun facts to me, I guess. Yeah. The day it was because of that, and then knowing gaining the technical know-how to look at the data sets, and more importantly before digital marketing and whatnot, you do focus groups, people still do that, market research, but now you have all this data that's captured by these cookies or on a website or by your behavior, and this information that could be sliced and diced to kind of observe how people are responding to a particular landing page or a particular ad or a synergy between maybe a television ad, and how does that lead to a lift in website traffic.
So you grew up in Singapore.
Mm-hmm.
You were really into chess as a kid.
Yeah.
So your mind always worked in a way like this.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you are a chess champion. Mm-hmm. As I was, what's the technical
under
title?
15, but it's been a long while.
Under 15 champion in Singapore. So, but you've always had this analytical mindset and approach, and uh-huh. I think that probably carries through. But I think it's really interesting that your first pursuit was on the creative side. Mm-hmm. So, what did you really, aside from the understanding in the photography space of throwing something out there and seeing what sticks, and really not being able to know without data, what else do you think you picked up in learning about everything that you're doing on the film side that you think has brought you to this place that you're at now?
Especially in advertising, I think one thing that my creative pursuits before that, I mean, still do so now, is that you cannot forget intuition. End of the day, you're trying to observe human behavior, and you do belong to a particular culture and time, and that just do define a certain behaviors and traits and beliefs for that particular moment. So even the data does say something, it's important to understand that general, I guess, psyche of a particular society is happening at a point in time. And that does inform you how you look at the data.
Interesting. And that's what I think is so important, because as so many people used to think, or maybe still think, that digital marketing is the juxtaposition between creatives and data. And I think not enough people really have an understanding that those two things are one and the same. That it's not just about having a good graphic designer that sits in the room with someone who understands data science. You really need somebody who can do both in some capacity, or an agency that has both people and the ability to bring those people together. But a real data-driven approach and being able to leverage this, whether it's with marketing or really any field of study, it requires a deep level of creativity. It really requires a level of creativity to be able to look at data on a screen and come up with a hypothesis about what are these numbers? Like, how did we get here, and what do they really mean? And for a long time, I used to think that a data-driven approach meant looking at a return on ad spend column and choosing to increase a bid on a keyword campaign because we were profitable, or looking at a search impression share column and saying, okay, well, we're going to, you know, things are more competitive than they were last month. That's not really what it means. That's a report. That's not taking a true data-driven approach. And what really, that gap is being able to look at that and say, well, why is this happening? And that's essentially where I think the true juxtaposition is. So when you got interested in this realm, right, and you were living in LA at the time when you found us, and you'd be moving across country. But actually, let's go to that for a second. Talk a little bit about like that transition, because you were not just like sort of switching industries, but also moving across the country.
Uh-huh. Oh, where do I start at that? Should I get a little personal on this?
Sure, whatever.
So at that point in time, I was with my ex-girlfriend back then. I mean, we're okay. It was like 10 years, whatnot. So I was like, okay, you know, go to New York, why not? You know, it was a nice transition. So it's a nice story to it. So, okay. So after I got this job, thankfully, the timing was perfect, actually. So, okay. So I was like, okay. I'm like, where do we begin? Okay, let's start with this. It gets a little dramatic. First, so when I wanted to move over, I had to move like a couple, like, you know, 7 or 8 boxes. I had a car. And at the point in time, I don't know, out of the blue, my ex-girlfriend was like, she made an accident. No injuries or whatnot, but her car was totaled. So I was like, okay, I don't want to drive over with a car. Let me give you that car. Oh my God. That's almost the real story as to why I gave her the car. And then I was like, okay, now how do I bring 7 or 8 boxes across the country? And then now I got no car. So I was like, okay, but then I don't want to spend too much money. So I decided to send those 7 or 8 boxes by Greyhound. So that took about a month and a half. And
a month and a half?
Yeah, a month and a half.
Was it, so did that overlap with when you moved here?
Yeah, because remember, I went back to Singapore first. That's always a nice plan.
Oh, right. Okay.
Yeah. But the thing with Greyhound, they would stop at every stop. So I don't know how many bus stops they stopped at. And I made one mistake with Greyhound. Okay, I get slandered here or what? I shipped 2 additional boxes. One was a Samsung speaker. One's an air purifier. They had a label on it. I don't know why. I was like, I think it's going to get stolen. It's Greyhound. But
this podcast is not brought to you by Greyhound.
Yeah, I was like, oh no. I want that faith in humanity that you won't get stolen.
Absolutely got stolen.
Yeah, got stolen. The other boxes was Home Depot boxes. Nobody touched them. But both boxes, I used the original boxes.
Yeah, that's a mistake you won't make twice.
I know. I was like, oh, I don't believe. Oh.
And the other part of that, because I forgot that you had went to Singapore the first time before you started here. But as you were being hired, you had said, listen, at some point next June, I have to go to Singapore. I have to do some stuff with my work visa and everything. And I was like, yeah, like whatever, of course. And then COVID hits.
Uh-huh.
And we completely forget. Like, I forgot that was still something that you had to do. And you had mentioned it one day and you're like, yeah, listen, like, I have to do that like this weekend. But the difference is I have to quarantine for 2 weeks when I get there so that I can then go to the embassy, turn around and come home. And you were basically locked in a hotel for 2 weeks in Singapore while working full time. Because you had nothing else to do, but uh-huh. Like slowly going crazy. What was that like? This is totally off topic, by the way, know, but I find it fascinating.
I know it's crazy. So, I mean, the short summary of it is that actually I didn't need to go back. Why? Here's why. So I went back. I was like, okay, I need to do my visa faster to do it at a U.S. embassy. So U.S. embassy in Singapore. So I went back, but it's like COVID, 14 days. All right. And like at the end of the tunnel, if after 14 days, sure, I get all the food, work. I brought my PlayStation along. I plug it to the hotel television. So I was like, okay, I'm quite entertained. But after 14 days, you know, I did my whole embassy appointment. So it was done before I even arrived in Singapore. Then when I finally, you know, after the quarantine, the U.S. embassy sends out an email. It's like, oh, we do not take appointments because it's COVID. They say they postponed my appointment by a week now. And I was like, okay, let me wait 3 days. Oh, they postponed it another week now. And by then I was like, yeah, I think I'll go fly back first before I even get an appointment. And fast forward, they only opened the appointments out, I think, November or something last year. So I was like, yeah, I didn't fly
so
back.
So that entire yeah, I didn't 2 week quarantine. Essentially jail sentence was all for nothing.
Yeah, uh-huh.
That's unbelievable. Okay, so now between the Greyhound stuff and the trips to Singapore and the quarantines, I guess you had started working for us before COVID actually hit. But you came into a company that we were much smaller at the time. We knew that there was, like, based on some of the conversations that we had had about a data-driven approach, mm-hmm. and you had worked on some projects for us, even, I don't remember if it was during your interview stage or, like, right after we hired you, we had this one problem with an account. We were trying to see if it was equitable to launch a new brand for them. I think it was right after you joined.
Yeah, right after, I think, the first month, right? Yeah.
And we were like, hey, Ben, listen, I don't know if you're, like, it was probably your first week, and we're like, we have this problem we're trying to solve. I have no idea how to solve it. We don't know what data we have access to. Can you help us with this hypothesis? And you turned around within like a day and a half and you had this like big, beautiful report. You ran this analysis and you did this like conclusive evidence. You pulled like zip code data and political polling stations and all this other stuff to like come with like real intelligent information that we can go back to the client with. And all of us looked at each other and were like, oh, wow, this guy like knows a bunch of stuff that we don't know. This is amazing. So that was really great. And we continued on those conversations, being able to think about like what do we not know about? And we started having some thoughts about attribution modeling and some other things that like we thought existed out there. And then it sort of took off from there. And at some point, the conversation became, okay, we need to build a legitimate analytics department here. Hmm. And we want you to figure out what that looks like. So talk about that whole experience and like bridging the gap. Did you know all along that that was the route that we were going to have to take? And that was really the real reason you were here to begin with? Or was there like some sort of trigger that went off that you figured, oh, I could essentially help build a company within this company?
I think the first thing first, because the first thing is I enjoy it. So that's why I was like, at least the project I'm referring to, when I first joined the company, it was like a kind of company level discussion. I think they were going to fly off to meet the client in a week's time. So I think the client was asking, should we launch a brand? You know, they were selling products that could lean on the political spectrum, but they want to lean in fully. But the whole idea was to, you know, should we or should we not? Now, what's our current customer base? And I realized that you can kind of glean political kind of affiliation information without a survey. I mean, of course, doing a polling would be the most efficient, but we have other information available.
Right. So surveys and all these other things are very expensive and just inefficient to run, mm-hmm. or at least in the time turnaround that we required here. So political information, political affiliation information is sort of, I mean, you would know better than I, but like it's sort of public data.
Exactly. So it was just that. So the idea is sometimes you just have to take a step back and not just be too, I guess, myopic with just looking at your own customer data. Because there's a lot of, end of the day, so you have a customer data set. And then if you want to understand more about the customer, what you're trying to find out is a unique identifier. So this particular analysis, the unique identifier was sales by zip code.
Right.
With zip code, I could identify on a county level. A county level has a group of zip codes in it. So I know that this sales came from this particular county, and the county information also publicly available. Well, who did it vote for?
Yeah.
whether it's for the House or the Senate or the President. So all the information can be joined together and we could kind of get a snapshot as to where our current customer base for our client, where the customer base lean towards. And we knew it was, I think, 60-40, but they want to lean really close, really into like 80-20. So we recommended that with the current website and the current customer branding, current customer base you have for this brand did not fit this new brand launch. But this new brand launch is going to go, let's say, it's politically incorrect. That's the whole idea of the brand launch. Yeah. And you want to make money, so you need to make sure that you have a website and a branding that's catered to that particular niche group. So that's why after looking at the data set, we felt that it's best to do a spin-off and launch that new brand. And it was that I thought was, I think it was insightful. It was a good recommendation.
It would have been very harmful to the brand if they had made that decision to launch those products under their existing umbrella.
Mm-hmm.
So the recommendation was to create a new brand entirely. And so they launched this new brand and you're aware, how did it go?
And you went to the roof, man. That was crazy.
It was incredible. They were printing money. It was probably the best recommendation that we've ever made for a client. And it could have been really bad if it wasn't for that analysis. Mm-hmm. And that really opened up a lot of doors for us. And this was a long time ago at this point. So we started going down this path a little bit more. We were lucky enough to be brought in for some consultative projects with some larger brands that we could flesh out this idea a little bit more about like, what does an analytics department really look like? And you were involved in all those other conversations. And thankfully we started to build out our team with more individuals that had a different perspective.
Mm-hmm.
So some of our earlier team members had a little bit of experience in this field, and then other people just naturally had an interest in it. So we were all of a sudden turned around and we had five or six people in a room that had an understanding, a deeper understanding about statistics and modeling than we had previously had. And we were able to tackle some of these problems with some actual intelligence and insight. So we turned around and said, okay, we actually want to build a department here. So, and we asked you to come to us and pitch what that looked like. So how did that initial stage go? And when you came to us and said, these are the first couple of people that we want to hire for these types of skill sets, because this is what's necessary if you actually want to be legitimate in this space.
Whew, that's a tough one, because all things considered, because you've been doing, it's a new department, and obviously resources will be tight, because you're learning on your feet at the same time and trying to scale it with the set of clients we have, the set of data set that we have. So what we identified quickly was we needed somebody that understood Python. Not just programming, because if you understood Python, you could develop an app, you could develop stuff, but you wanted somebody that had that programming language and the understanding of statistics. So that's the first person that we hired, Abby. I think that's very important to get it out of the way. The reason why this is important, statistics is important, because at the end of the day, coding is coding, but you need to know the math to translate it to the code, and the code to kind of accelerate the process. So understanding statistics to understand what kind of questions and what kind of methods can you apply. It's a bit like choosing, should I use a hammer or should I use a chisel in a particular situation? You need to know. And once you know why Python comes important, that's why you wanted to hire Abby, is because the data sets are really huge. You're talking about very large data sets that depends, something goes to the millions. I mean, depends on the kind of clients. It can crash the Excel file. So when with Python, it allows us to kind of accelerate the process, to kind of organize that data. And the thing about data sets, I think people out there that are familiar with this, 50 or 60% of the time is cleaning the data set. So we need a method to clean fast. And after cleaning the data set, the two things that really give us the most work is cleaning data set and asking the right questions. That's not easy. Asking the right questions is actually the toughest part.
Yeah. And you had sort of outlined, like, listen, we need someone that can come in with this set of skills because of these three problems, essentially. It was, we need someone that can do, like, that understands Python for some of the coding elements of it, with sort of the purpose of, or a separate purpose of cleaning data, spending a lot of time cleaning data. And then all of this is important because these data sets are too big that they crash Excel.
Mm-hmm.
And really the only one of those that I even conceptualized personally was the Excel crashing point, because I've experienced that myself. But also I have this memory of our VP of strategy, Nechama, who's also a very bright data-minded individual. There was, I forget what she was trying to solve for years ago, but there was this massive Excel file that she was working with that it kept crashing. So she figured out a way to launch the program overnight, knowing that she would go to bed and wake up the next morning and hopefully it would have loaded. But even that wasn't enough, because then she had to somehow scroll to the bottom and the keyboard functions weren't working. So she tied a rubber band in a way with her mouse and just got up and like ended up going to bed the next night and let it finally scroll to the bottom for her. So it's like, okay, there's some problems here that like Microsoft Excel by itself can't solve. Nahama's trying to jerry-rig like a rubber band mouse situation to try and do like a pretty basic analysis for a client. And what we're trying to ask now of Ben is like 10 times more complicated. So I'm going to listen to whatever, I don't even know what data cleaning even is, but I'm going to take his word for it. So we brought in Abby, who spends a lot of her time doing these types of things and has been a huge asset to the company. But it's so interesting that she spends so much of her day doing some things that I didn't even know existed 2 years ago. So now that just opens up more conversations, and now all of a sudden the pieces start to fall in place. So what do you think, like, where do you think we are now compared to where we were then in terms of the types of things that we're able to do, the types of projects and analyses that we're able to do for clients?
I think we definitely grew a portfolio, because I think at least at the beginning for last year, the method we employed was regression. So that was it's quite a common method in many of the market analysis or any analysis or any companies do market research. But we were able to grow our understanding of reading regression information, whether it's the R-square or the p-value, because sometimes you have to make a margin call. I mean, a little bit dramatic here, whether it's p-value or whether it's the R-square, the coefficients that indicate to us, because at the end of the day, it's the human behavior. And any analysis of a data set will always be some level of snapshot of a particular moment.
Mm-hmm.
So it took a while to kind of understand and make that judgment, because numbers will say numbers, but at the end of the day, people still look to us for a recommendation on those numbers.
Right.
And sometimes we do recommend against what the numbers are saying. The numbers are saying something, we say sus. We say, no, that's not correct. And I think that took a while, at least, I mean, over like a year, to kind of understand those numbers in the context of the real world. Because it's a little different from using this statistical modeling for, say, manufacturing, you know, 10 nails, 5 screws, 2 tons of iron, mix your car or something like that. It's going to remain within the set variables.
Right, but with marketing, it's human behavior. Human behavior. It's always going to be different.
Yeah, so that makes it a little scarier and a little more difficult. So I would say the numbers help us narrow down the list of options that we or list of scenarios we're considering. Maybe when you come to a particular problem at hand or question, it's like, oh, I don't know what's this. Maybe there's 10 possible scenarios. Using data analysis and looking at the data help us narrow down and kind of scope down what's the real issue at hand, so we know how to strategize for the client.
Perfect. And to make it, for anyone that might be listening that's like, I thought these guys ran PPC ads, like, what does any of this have to do? I think to give a practical example, you were tremendously helpful in helping me better understand one client's the value of their Google Shopping ads, and in particular how to really measure the efficacy of smart shopping campaigns relative to standard shopping campaigns. Mm-hmm. And what really kind of changed the way I was thinking about it is you ran these regression models and time decay analysis, and you had come up with a model that said for every dollar that we spent on Google Shopping, we measured $5.39 in return, which is different than what's reported in the Google Ads dashboard.
Mm-hmm.
On the Google Ads dashboard, it's reporting a 400% return, which is for every dollar invested, we're getting $4 in return. So my question was like, I don't understand. How are you saying that we were actually generating more revenue than Google is saying we earned? And the answer was, well, because that's just how they choose to attribute.
Yeah.
Like, you're not factoring in like all these other possible scenarios, like whether or not somebody clicked on the ad, whether or not you're just not tracking that, if they're browsing, if they cleared their cookies or at some point, like none of this stuff is perfect. Like, they're all models, and yeah, not like just because Google is saying one thing and you're living and dying by it, like it's just a model.
Yeah.
None of this is perfect. And I was like, oh God, why didn't I never realize that before? So what was really interesting, though, is when you compared the standard shopping campaigns, which are the traditional product listing ads that have been around for, I don't know, 10 years at this point, with, in the same account, the results of smart shopping campaigns. And you looked at, I think, 3 years of data for each of those categories. And you came, and in the Google Ads dashboard, they reported around the same number of return on ad spend. Mm-hmm. It was around a 400% return. But your model showed that the smart shopping campaign actually returned at above $9
mm-hmm.
per every dollar spent, whereas standard reported only $5.
Mm-hmm.
And that was mind-blowing because it's the same type of ad format, plus or minus a few different bells and whistles, but there was an added impact that there was driving more, it was driving more brand lift, it was driving more direct traffic to the site, it was having this added value that we never would have realized if we were just going by what Google was telling us. And which is so funny because so many people blame the ad platforms for over-reporting on results. And they say, well, Facebook is taking credit for view-through conversions, and that's bad. But in reality, we're actually looking at this from a lens of, that's definitely happening. Like, there are certainly times where the platforms are over-reporting, but there are also probably times where they're under-reporting.
Mm-hmm.
And you're making budgetary decisions, and you're possibly missing out on revenue because you're not understanding the full picture. And whether or not, like your model is not perfect and Google's model is not perfect, but we can now use two different perspectives to make a real informed decision.
Mm-hmm.
That's ultimately going to help be for the best case of the client. The last piece of that, which blew my mind and was the biggest takeaway from this entire aspect, was you measured whether or not an impression
mm-hmm.
was driving brand lift and incremental revenue on the website. And with standard shopping campaigns, they were not. But with smart shopping campaigns, which smart shopping is a Google feature that includes ads that are served with Google shopping ads, but also display ads, YouTube ads, and Gmail ads. And your analysis found that in this account in particular, the smart shopping ads, just the impressions themselves, were making a positive impact in driving overall revenue to the site, which is incredible because it's still a pay-per-click model.
Mm-hmm.
So we're getting free impressions. And as we saw a lift in impressions, we saw a statistically correlated lift in revenue. And that was incredible knowledge to know and learn about. And that has really helped a lot of decisions that we've been making for a lot of our e-commerce clients. We continue to measure these things and try to keep ourselves in check. But this is the type of thing that I don't think anyone else was looking at. So that's a practical example. And that was really just progression analysis. This is the simpler version of what you've really been working on. So as we continue to go on this path and try and solve more complicated problems, what are some of the other, like, what does that road look like? Like, how have we gone even deeper into this value chain in a way?
Oh, I think there's one good example. The two analysis that we did for, can I say the client?
Sure.
Microaround. So Microaround came around and... So it's established brand, you know, established brand, great products, and there were two main questions that the account manager asked. I think the main one was he wanted to find out, and we do ask that question quite often. People do ask before I guess the whole analytics department came around. Many wanted to know is there, I don't like to use the word, but a gateway product.
Yeah. I like that term. Is there a gateway product? Is there a first product that people are likely to buy into the brand?
Mm-hmm.
So like the example that I like to use in this is like Yeti, like the cooler, Yeti coolers, where is it that people first buy a cooler or are they interested in the brand and they buy a hat or a koozie? Like I have a bunch of Yeti koozies, but I don't have a Yeti cooler. Mm-hmm. But at some point in my life, I'll probably buy a cooler.
Uh-huh.
So that's the Yeti coffee mug was my gateway drug into the brand.
For this client, it's a good example that you gave about Yeti cooler because it's a legitimate theory. People do behave that way. And you wanted to find out for this particular client is that a gateway product that eventually leads to the sales or other complementary products or collection? And this is important because we do see such behavior and so the principle behind it is the Pareto principle. There's also, obviously, there's other distribution. The most famous one, obviously, is the bell curve for the normal distribution. You see that in whether it's in chess talent or tennis talent or even height. Somehow, for whatever reason, maybe there's a grand design to things, but you see that distribution on the bell curve. Why? There's no reason to it other than when you observe
that. Meaning that you regress to the mean.
Yeah.
For most samples of data.
Most samples of data, except for particularly for several very unique scenarios. I don't want to go to the debate. Income inequality is one. We do not know why. We do not see a normal distribution to that. And we also don't see that for products all the time. That oddly, especially for products that this particular client sells, right? At least 80% of revenue is determined by this. A set top 20% products. It's not everything. It's not even. There's no bell curve. It's skewed towards a particular set. Very heavy skewed to a particular set. And that's it. And every other product that sells maybe 10. And this is very interesting. So this analysis, you wanted to find out, is there a gateway product? So it's two analysis to it. The simple one was to look at the products that drove the top 80% of the revenue. We identified no more than just 20, 25 products actually. That's it. So we did a second analysis, which to answer the original question, which was, is there a gateway product? And the idea here was to look at repeat customers. So repeat customers is defined as to order more than two orders in a particular year. So that's how we define it. And once we're able to define what's a repeat customer, we look at all their purchase orders. Because if you think of it, Shopify, Magento, every order is time-stamped. We can actually look in a particular year when you first come in or when you first came in. We can group them because so it's a first order. Anybody that first order, group all these products in one chart or whatnot or one table. Second order, you group it. Third order, you group it. Visualize it. You can see the change. And interestingly, while I mentioned the first kind of example, the whole 80-20 or Pareto principle, and this analysis, we saw no difference. So for the top 20% products that drove 80% of the revenue, right? There was a set list, like I think 20, 25 products. And for the repeat customers, so they have a set products they order for the first order, second order, and the third order, and then different set of products, sure. end of it, end of the day for the repeat purchases, the top products, whether it's the first order, second order, or third order, is similar to the 80-20.
So there was not a gateway product.
But they were top performing products, and the set, there's a type of collections that people prefer. So there's this 25 that repeated, whether it's the repeat customers or just one-time purchases, we saw that pattern. So that's where we realized, okay, there's no gateway product, but we have, okay, product, maybe you could call it gateway products because there's at least 25, but they do just end up buying either this or that, but it just rotates between the 25. So the recommendation here was, especially on the Facebook side, because this is important, it was like, they came to us saying, so what products are going to feature? Are we going to just do a catalog ad, let Facebook decide, and we don't need to decide on the creatives? But you wanted to be a little smart about it, because we knew that this is now we know there's a set of products that we can, that people tend to buy, and this helps scope down the, especially on the creative side. So what creatives should we show, what products should we feature? Now we know the set of products mm-hmm. that people do engage most, or do purchase most, and they like it at the end of the day. That's what they're saying. And this way you can scope down the kind of assets we want to create, and it's informed by data. It's not just, oh, okay, this looks pretty, it's going to be a creative, but know that what products do drive the best success for the client. And then we inform the creative team. The creative team decide, okay, how to visualize that.
Which is full circle from your original photography mm-hmm. pursuit of saying, oh, well, I want to know which products are likely going to actually drive magazine or drive subscriptions in this mm-hmm. magazine ad. Now you actually know that. You have a method of being able to figure out what are the products that we should be featuring in our ads, and it's actually informed by data.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Incredible. So that's deeper level stuff, and that is really actionable, and that's really great, not just insight for the client, because now they can kind of operate within that, but it also informs some of the stuff that we're doing on a day-to-day. We're still in this journey of filling out this program and evaluating all the different methods that we can use. So I want to run through a few of them. Mm-hmm. And if you can give just like the elevator pitch as to like what that is and why it's useful. If we start, so we have regression, mm-hmm. right? So like explain the elevator pitch on that and where and why it's useful. In the context of digital advertising.
So in context of digital advertising, so what regression does is just to, there's two parts of it, to correlate or to find a causation. Causation, I will not speak about it, it's more complex than that. But why we do regression so often is because there's a lot of data sets that that can be joined together, but are not digital. And through regression, we can measure the output of a particular behavior by using statistics. And because if you do not use statistics, we end up defaulting to any attribution model that whatever platform prescribes you. But that does not mean that it's just the source of truth. Because mm-hmm. at the end of the day, you know your numbers, you know, whether you're selling something or not. And you want to find out why are they selling to begin with. Facebook says something, Google says something. Where do we really, really land? And right. That's when statistics come to kind of be like kind of a secondary check or to kind of show kind of source of truth. So you can see, okay, there's a range of where we're working with, so we really know. But where regression really comes in, I think it's just especially offline data. There's right. lots of offline data, offline behavior that we need to connect back.
So measuring the impact of a TV ad mm-hmm. or a Spotify ad.
Yeah.
That's or right. even, I mean, we talk about this a lot, is like YouTube ads. You're really not going to see a lot of the conversion data from any sort of like brand performance type campaign, because you're going to see it, you're going to try and measure it based on like a lift in direct traffic to the site or something. But without a true formula and a model to prove whether or not it's driving revenue, you're just not going to see it in Google. Like you need something that's external, and that's essentially pulling in offline data when you can. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's regression. The next thing I think that we have on this list here is survey analysis. Everyone knows what a survey is, but how do you think there's a unique spin on it in pulling this information in to make it actionable for digital ad campaigns?
I think the great thing about surveying is pretty old school. It's always been around and whatnot. But I thought something that we can do and when we should do is because it's a nice way, especially when you want to reach out and understand your client sentiment. I think surveys does a really good job in doing so. And it, with this analysis, it helps inform clients to learn how to separate their email list, because you can pay for surveys and $10 a survey or whatnot, get information, but even do it for free as possible. The important part here is how do you slice and dice your email list, because once you're able to slice and slice your segment or email list, this way we can do surveys and compare two different groups. And that's important. Let's say people that do read your email, you do your email blast, your email campaign, whatnot, they do open often. Some open at the same rate, but purchase. We can actually send a survey to people that open at the same rate, slice the list into half, and one that purchase might ask why. Mm-hmm. And there's ways to do so. I mean, you don't need to pay for, you still need to pay us for it, I hope. But you don't need to pay for surveys. There's a lot of this customer information or customers that you already have a list, and there's ways to kind of glean more insights from your customers just by organizing a list properly.
And I think with that, we've learned this the hard way, that surveys are very expensive to run and administer and very time consuming. And if you're not doing it the right way, it could be the biggest waste of money that you've ever invested in.
Yeah.
And I mean, we've done it, right? Mm-hmm. You've laughed at us in hearing stories about ways that we've administered surveys. I mean, like, you've just wasted amounts of money that I don't even want to speak about because it's so frustrating. But yeah, so there has to be a methodology and a strategy behind that. Okay. So the next thing, do you have any sort of example or practical example about some sort of sales trend analysis and tying that into, I imagine, forecasting in a way?
So there's two analyses that I found. I like to call or borrow from Google whenever they release the betas. So sales trend and I'll say linear optimization are the two analyses that I'll call it still within beta, because it's not too easy to kind of predict those. Like a sales trend, we can identify patterns. Like I give for example was the micro RAM. So that patterns within behavior of what they purchase and what they can go towards. But the difficulty of it all is with sales trend, we're trying to predict not just digital, but for the business, the holistic picture for the business. And that becomes a little difficult because the reason for this analysis, I mean, we're still trying. I think that's ask me again 6 months time. But the goal of it is to try to see where they land, correct, in the future. So what drives that is really, at the end of the day, is trying to predict the future, where they land 6 months, 9 months in kind of revenue. Obviously, we're assuming all things constant. But what variables are we really changing here is really the media spend, the media strategy around it. And that, like linear optimization, the difficulty of that, whether it's a sales trend analysis or linear optimization, the second the part that answering that question or questions is attribution. That is difficult because, sure, I can do a financial approach to sales trend analysis, which your Goldman Sachs or whatever, they release their quarterly reports or where Netflix is going to land, their price per share and whatnot. You can do that kind of a financial modeling, which we can do if you want to hire us. But the idea is to recommend to the account managers how to spend their media.
Right.
Because we think the revenue is going to be here based on industry trends, whatnot, GDP. But how much are we going to spend, correct? Because that's what people are hiring us for. So they're not going to hire us just to produce a kind of market report. They want to know that with this market report, how are we using it for media spend? And that goes back to attribution, which is difficult with the whole changes that's happening for iOS 14, 14.5. It's hard to observe such behaviors. The math is there. We are trying to crack the code. So right now, not yet. But I think those are the two, especially linear optimization. I love the math behind it, but it's a struggle to try to
Also a lot of inputs, right? Also the data cleaning aspect of it in the Python, and we're looking at some other technology that we're hopefully going to bring on that can help solve some of these problems. Mm-hmm. But you had made the comment to me yesterday, and I had said, like, isn't this something we can solve with linear programming? And you made a joke to say, like, if that was the simple answer, then you should IPO a company because it just can't really be done. Theoretically it could, but it's a very, very hard problem to solve.
Yeah, it's a hard problem to solve because a couple of variables, linear optimization, the math of end of it is that I want to get a set output. Maybe I want to get, like, you do, so whoever you do it does Google Ads or Facebook, ROAS target and whatnot. It's the same math behind Google's AI approach, which is actually linear optimization. But they do well because they have their data within Google, so they optimize well. Facebook has their data, or maybe not now, but they do optimize with it. But now, as an agency, we're talking about cross-channel kind of optimization.
So
without the data, that's.
You know. And let me try and break this down because I feel like we just glossed over that. But this is a true example of the value of this type of study, because when you look at Google and say, okay, well, we want to have a shared budget or we want to have a smart shopping campaign, and our target return on ad spend is 400%, and we're going to trust that Google is going to be able to spend our budget across 3,000 products and hopefully be able to return the best results ever.
Mm-hmm.
And the question of how do they allocate that budget across all these products? And the answer is because they have their own methods of linear optimization in terms of making a prediction about product A versus product B and making a decision in real time about whether or not you should spend that budget. So if you look at any sort of pacing, how, you know, discount pacing in terms of we're going to spend X amount over the course of the day. Let's say you have a $1,000 budget in your Google ad campaign in a day. Google's trying to generate as much revenue with that as possible. It's not on accelerated delivery. It's not just spending that based off of how many people are performing searches on Google or clicking on ads, and then there's a potential that you'll run out of budget by 8 a.m. It's the complete opposite of that. Google uses linear optimization to be able to pace your budget evenly throughout the day to maximize the amount of return that it can get. Facebook does the same thing. That's why things like campaign budget optimization are so valuable.
Mm-hmm.
However, the question becomes, one, when you're doing cross-channel, so how do you have a budget when you have Facebook, Google, you're running ads on Pinterest, LinkedIn, and all these other types of platforms? How do you allocate that at the top level? But also when you have other elements of your product stack or your strategy that isn't as easily translated or transferred that Google can figure out in real time. Maybe there's a particular product that is more valuable to you. Maybe you did uncover the gateway product mm-hmm. that you're trying to specialize and set out. So these types of things can be solved with very, very complicated math, but that's where linear optimization comes to play.
Yeah, and I think it's difficult. I think the math, we can do it. It's just the attribution thing that we've been exploring, like GA4, BigQuery, Define. End of the day is unique identifiers. There's a reason why the Google Analytics defaults to last click, because they haven't solved this issue. And mm-hmm. that's why with last click, they know you came from a referral site and you entered the website. There's information that can be observed, could be gleaned, and that's why they default to last click. But what about views?
Right.
What about television? There's things that do matter, but there's no observable behavior. It's like, how do I know somebody's eyeball was on this ad?
Right.
or television ad. So it's very, very difficult for those metrics to observe, but we know it's important. That's why the idea of the lean optimization and what we're working on is hopefully, I don't know it's possible or not, we were trying to find any kind of a ways to kind of holistically bring all this data set so we can have a nice view of our customer.
And I think the important thing is we're doing these analyses every day, and it's not as if like we're not getting answers. We're still getting answers, but we're getting models that we still feel can be improved.
Mm-hmm.
So we're still running linear optimization for some clients and spitting out budget models and all these other things. But we just know that if we can unlock a greater sense of different variables to pull into that program and to be able to do so at scale, it's like it would be a tremendous breakthrough for us and be able to do that for multiple clients and all these different use cases.
Yeah, and this is an important point because it's not static. I think, you know, they go, they do have their own AI system and do adjust, and that's the tough part to kind of see. So we can sure, I mean, any training of a AI system involves a historical data set. So they do observe certain behavior and say, oh, maybe a range of frequency 4 to 8 for brand awareness campaigns, clicks maybe 2, and maybe the window is between 7 to 14. Lean optimization know that ranges from a trained data set and they adjust. But
right.
How do you train that data set to know if they're shifting?
Right.
So exactly. they had to recalculate on the fly. Is it a 7 to 14 days window, or is it a 3 to 10 impressions now, or is it 12? Is it changing? And that's just difficult to kind of. Because it's not just math here, not just lean optimization, it's not just about attribution, it's also creating a whole system so the data can talk to itself.
Exactly. The last piece I want to hit on is just to circle back to the importance of creativity in this, because none of this stuff will ever become a conversation if someone didn't start with that if someone didn't have an idea about what's happening and be able to ask that question.
Mm-hmm.
Because all this stuff is just answers to questions that people have to ask. And it's really hard work, but a lot of it is just finding the right question and then doing a lot of cleaning of the data. And then ultimately the actual analysis takes, you know, a couple minutes. But one of the problems that we had recently solved was a new client came on board, and just in going through the minutiae of the Facebook account, had realized that there had been no coherent strategy to their remarketing efforts. Some months they had spent a lot, some months they had spent very little, and there wasn't it wasn't very clear on like what they were trying to do or what the net impact of mm-hmm. that was. So we had just thrown that idea out to you and your team and said, hey, listen, like, can you figure out if there's a way to measure like whether or not the remarketing is actually making any impact? Is there essentially a correlation between larger remarketing spend and an overall increase in customers? And it wasn't like, it's a simple question to ask. It's not exactly the simplest question to answer because there's a lot of different variables that you have to pull and clean to be able to get an answer to that. Ultimately, you had found there was no correlation. And so we went to the client and recommended and said, hey, listen, we're going to cut out 70% of your marketing budget tomorrow. And we actually don't expect that to negatively impact the amount of sales we're getting because we have data that shows that your remarketing is not actually working. That doesn't mean it can't work. That doesn't mean that we should throw away the strategy forever. But as it's currently set up, the current remarketing campaigns that are running in your account, they're just wasting money. So we're going to drop those out and we're automatically going to see a positive reduction in your cost per customer acquisition. And they were like, oh, you know, like they were like, oh, that sounds great. What? Like they couldn't believe the fact, like we had talked about all the statistical modeling and then we got to like the punchline, the big reveal of like, so we think that this is actually going to have an immediate impact on your campaign starting today. And like, they were absolutely blown away. And like going into a meeting with that level of confidence because of that analysis that took, I mean, I know that you had spent like a good 2 days working on that specifically, is just next level type of stuff that we're able to do now. And it is, it's a lot of fun. I mean, I guess for me to be able to talk about those results is one thing, but it really is incredible to be able to use that as part of our overall strategy and our product stack. So I think that this type of work is really exciting. This is just the beginning of it. We're continuing to develop all these new ways to do this at scale and more effectively. And every single client that we've worked with has posed a new challenge. Mm-hmm. And just asking those questions and having everybody learn more about the different problems that we can solve has been, it's been very energetic. As far as like, oh my goodness, like I never thought we'd be able to dive into that. It's been such a cool topic. So I'm excited for where it's going to go. But yeah, do you have any like last thoughts as far as like where we are in the current state of this and what the next step is and what you are excited about, where we're going from a data standpoint?
I guess for any, I'm speaking about data analysts and whatnot, but I think working with a larger data set and more complex questions do just to challenge me and to challenge the team. So that's what I like. And this, before I guess I end this podcast, a shout out to Avery and Nakama. They ask the toughest questions. So whenever they come to me, I'm always half excited or half scared. I was like, let me hide in the bathroom.
Amazing. Ben, it's been a pleasure. My last question, as always, what's your opinion on the best place to hide a dead body?
The second page of a search engine result.
Why did you say it like that? Amazing. Okay, so thank you, Ben. This has been the How to Hide a Dead Body podcast. Appreciate having you on. And to everyone listening, we'll see you next time.